This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, since the last time we've done a podcast, something big has happened in your life. Are you now an author?
I am an author. Yes.
Tell us all about this.
I'm glad you asked, Rahul. Yeah. So our book, showing it on the screen now, entitled Bad Medicine, came out last week, available on Amazon for $3.50. It really focuses on litigating medical malpractice cases. There's some topics that are specific to my home jurisdiction of Maine, but I would say 90% of it has general applicability if you're doing medical malpractice cases anywhere in the country. So the goal of it is to kind of help people issue spot and provide kind of short summaries of each different topic rather than going in depth on any particular thing. So I think people would find it helpful to take a look at. If it's not worth $3.50, you can write in and let me know.
Full refund?
Full refund, 100%. Satisfaction guaranteed.
Did you publish it yourself?
We published it ourselves. We just, basically what it is a compilation of articles that my partner and I have published over the last 2.5 years. So we took an editor and had the articles edited, the cover designed, and put it out as a book. So it's a book without having to write a book. Now, speaking of books, right? Good segue.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I just, one thing before we transition into that, you know, you're all highbrow with being an author now and things like that. A guy like you probably has some, you know, high-end landscapers that just came over to your house. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you must be referring to my Facebook post of the, so every year around this time, we schedule these goats to come to the house. And there's a company in Maine that offers what they call goatscaping. So the goats come, they enclose them in a fence in the area you want to be addressed. And then the goats spend a week or 2 weeks just eating all of the weeds and grass in that area. I actually came to learn about this because the woman who owns the goatscaping business is a former client of mine. So we got to talking about it. And this is a third or fourth year in a row. Great. It's really great. You know, the goats do a good job. It's fun to have them around. And you know, we'll do things like have friends over for goat happy hours. And you know, you could do some yoga. There's no limit to really what you can do with goats. So, well, there is a limit. I shouldn't say that, but yeah. Anyway, yeah, so that's what we're doing. We're goatscaping right now.
That's amazing.
If you check out, posted some photos. I'll post a photo on the Elevate site. How about that?
Now that's a perfect segue.
Oh, yeah, better segue. Speaking of the goat, we have the goats of big data on the show today, John and Alicia Campo.
Wow, you made that work.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive, huh?
Yeah.
Not only do they are they the goats of big data, but they also have a new book. So the segue is absolutely right on. So John, we've had you on before. We have not had Alicia on before, but I understand you are the, you know, the brains behind the operation, Alicia. So why don't you just introduce yourselves to our listeners who don't know you and just tell us a little bit about both of you and what you do, and then we'll get into the new book and your and big data.
All right. So I think I talked to some people throughout empirical, well, not empirical jury, but Campbell law. I work with John on these cases, and I was one of the first cases that we ever did this way, actually. When John came up with this idea in 2016, we ran my case. I had a mortgage fraud case I was slated for trial on that had 16 defendants. And so what I needed to know is, were there people that I could let out without hurting my underlying claim? Because we had, you know, so many people. And so John was at DU at that time and was like, hey, you know what? We should run it and test it and let's let jurors tell us. And that's what we did. And little did I know at that point, that would start our whole adventure of studying cases and figuring out how jurors know best about so many things. So since then, 2016, we've been working on this. We've studied what, over 600 cases. My background is as a teacher. I was a teacher. We went to law school at night, and I got my start in St. Louis. I'm a lawyer from the Lou. And I still practice there. I started out in mortgage fraud, had my own firm, and still have my own firm, but now I'm doing excessive force cases. So in addition to doing this studying jurors part, we are also litigating on behalf of clients, which I like because I get to study my own cases and litigate them as well. So
yeah,
that's pretty much me. Simple, yeah.
So you've met the better half. Alicia and I have been, it's funny, we've been married. Tomorrow we will celebrate 21 years of marriage. And we've been law partners a lot less time than that. But since what, 2012? 2014. Right, 9 years we've been law partners. And the last 7 years we've been studying cases with big data.
Yeah.
I started off at a law firm too in St. Louis, an injury firm. Ended up running a class action department, but always still got dropped into and sometimes helped with trials of injury cases. And then took a job at the University of Denver Law School. Fast forward to getting really fascinated with the idea that you could study cases empirically, that you could use methods that look more like what we're used to in medicine or social science or tech, where you get hundreds of people to look at what you call a stimuli, which is the presentation or whatever you want them to look at, and get their responses. And as Alicia said, you know, we weren't ever looking to form sort of a big data company or a way to study cases. We studied one of Alicia's cases because I started thinking, and we kind of talked about it and thought we could probably get better answers to the questions we have about the case if we knew what hundreds of people thought instead of what 10 think, right? And at the same time, the same week, the second case we studied was a case that John Simon, Ben and Rahul, you probably both know John, and John's an Inner Circle member, great lawyer, and taught me to be a lawyer. And John had a really interesting injury case, but it was difficult to know what the appropriate non-economic damage ask was. And we studied the case using big data, and we manipulated, meaning we showed different jurors different non-economic damage requests. And since we showed about 100 people each one and didn't change anything else, we could then say, playing the odds, this non-economic damage request is the most overall effective request. And between Alicia's case and his, we were kind of onto something, and then got invited to talk to the Inner Circle that same year. Still weren't looking to form a company, but people said, tell us what you're doing or how this works. And we got busy somewhat unexpectedly with people saying, let's look at cases. And yeah, fast forward to today. I mean, you know, that's what we do a lot of, is study cases around the country, only for plaintiffs' lawyers, trying to figure out, using really big samples, what's working in the case, what isn't working, how likely you are to win the case, what its value is, who good and bad jurors are, and lots of other pressing questions. And we've had a lot of fun with it and a lot of success.
So what led to the writing of the book, Empirical Jury?
Yeah, so the book is actually called Jury Ball, and play on the movie Moneyball, which most people are familiar with, right? The idea that you can be a better scout, coach, whatever in sports by infusing your decision-making with data. And we thought, that's right. You can be a better trial lawyer. You can pick a better jury. You can try a better case if you're informing your decisions with data. Data will never replace lawyering. It'll never replace all the skills we learn from the greats that write books about trial law and about how to present and about how to frame and rules of the road and don't eat the bruises and brutal honesty and everything else we can name. But all those people.
Don't forget.
Yeah, bad medicine, of course, is the newest and greatest. But you can sort of weaponize those skill sets if you have really good information about the case and you can play the odds. The book is interesting in that it's not just data. It's primarily, it's a lot about data, and it's certainly about infusing data into your practice. But we wrote it with Sean Claggett, who couldn't join us today, but is a co-author of the book with Alicia and I. And what we've learned is that you can study cases and get all the information about the case. And for many lawyers, like the both of you that we've done studies with, if you have that information, you'll go try great cases. But there's also a lot of lawyers who are still developing who, if they only have the data, they may not implement it. And it's not because they don't want to. There's real struggles in how to. And there's muscle memory, right? In making yourself be able to talk in the opening in the way that's most effective about this case, in practicing your voir dire until you can sort of ask those questions smoothly and walk the right jurors off, all that kind of thing. And so what developed without any planning, I mean, as many things in life, was a relationship with Sean Claggett where we kept ending up on cases with him where he was working as kind of a lawyer consultant. And then Sean was hooked on the data. He loves data. And so he had always been asking us to study his cases. And what we found is if we were consulting with somebody and we did the data and Sean and his partner Jordan and sometimes Will Sykes did work days with him, that implementing the data in that way and sort of then using it to shape the opening, the directs and crosses, the selection, and getting attorneys really comfortable with it produced some really good results.
That would not have been my answer.
What would your answer have been?
Sean wanted a reason to come to Madrid.
He was just looking for it. He came out. We worked on the book for a week or two in Madrid. And it might have just been he wanted an excuse to come to Madrid. He might not like us or even find it useful. I don't know. He's not here to say.
So our listeners understand you guys live in full time now in Madrid, Spain.
We do. We live in Madrid. Proud parent moment. Our son, this is the crazy thing for Americans, right? Our son last weekend, his team won the championship of Madrid, which means they're the state champs because Madrid is like New York, New York. It's a city and a state. They're the state champs in Madrid. And so we have a life here. But of course, as you can imagine, as American lawyers, both still with cases and then studying lots of cases, we're in the U.S. a lot. But our kids call this home.
You guys, I think we've done 3 studies together. And I know Rahul recently did one. We're about to send you another one. I don't know if it's been sent over, but we're going to do another one soon. And one thing I've noticed is that the data and the results seem like they've been continually refined so that there's different formatting of the reports, different ways in which you're presenting the data. You guys probably have done more of this data analysis than any other humans in the world at this point in terms of analyzing juror data. So you sort of have a big data set of big data. What have you learned from doing so much big data analysis over, you know, over 500 cases that you didn't know when you first embarked on this process?
Great question. A couple of things that come to mind right away, and Alicia, when you think of them, say them. Maybe a couple of things that were really surprising. So, or at least now we take as old hat, but would be surprising. And yeah, to put it in context, I mean, I was thinking the other day, we have studied about 200,000 jurors. And then in the academic world, I've studied at least another 10,000. And so, yeah, I think we've got a lot of data points and we are starting now to go back and do sort of macro analysis of that data. But some things are already clear. So, for example, most attorneys think that how much they ask for in a non-economic damage request, assuming you're in a place where they'll let you say a number, most attorneys think that will affect how much they get. And that's true, it will. But most attorneys don't know or are surprised to hear how much it will affect their likelihood of winning. So, for example, we often study cases where we'll test 3 different non-economic damage requests, and that's the only thing we change, right? That's the variable that we're manipulating. And so jurors don't know what's happening. They're blinded to the manipulation. They're just seeing and hearing and watching and participating in a case, and then they hear an ask for 10 million, or let's say the second is 20 million and the third is 40 million. We know that we have groups now, A, B, and C, that have seen different non-economic requests, and we've controlled for everything else. Of course, we'll see the damages that are given change, but we often see the win rate, the percentage of jurors that vote for the plaintiff change by as much as 15%. Well, in a tight case, the difference between winning 70% of jurors, right? Let's say one is 70%, and in the worst request, 55%. Isn't just a 15% swing. It's the difference between having a clear majority in deliberation and having a divided jury. And another thing we know from the data is that if you have a clear majority when deliberation begins, you almost always, although not always, win. And if you start with a divided jury, it is at best a coin toss, and it tends to favor the defense. And so if you were just pointing out one crazy thing, it would be that if you don't refine how much you ask for, you could actually cost yourself the case on liability. And the inverse is true. If you refine how much you ask for, sometimes you could take a tight case and make it better because of the credibility of the ask. That's one that stands out to me as sort of counterintuitive.
If you don't ask for enough, you can cost yourself. I mean, in a very real way. If you're not asking for enough in damages and you presented a really great case, then jurors don't understand why you're underselling what you're asking for.
No, that's right. You can see the win rate dip because of a too low request, just like a too high request. And so there's actually really is in almost all cases a sweet spot.
Can I ask you about that?
Yeah, of course.
You mentioned that applies to non-economic damages. What about economics? Like, for example, we have a case now where we have a $60 million life care plan. Does that have the same impact on outcomes as the non-economics or not?
No, typically not in the same way, right? So the non-economic damage has an effect because if a juror is on the fence and they perceive your ask as either so lacking in confidence, too low, or so greedy, too high, without them consciously thinking, it gives them an excuse to just vote defense, right? On the economic damages, it's a little different, although maybe the underlying mechanism might be similar, which is if your economics are solid and when challenged by the defense in cross and everything else, there's not a lot of fluff. It's just that the life care plan really is $60 million. Then what you're maintaining is your credibility, and you're not giving them any reason to sort of, so it's not that they say, oh, this is too high. It's that they say you're greedy or you don't believe in your case. So where economics can hurt, and if Sean were on here, we would talk about his cases. We can still talk about it some is, you know, Sean had a case where the economic damages weren't that substantial. They were only like $500,000 he could request, but they were for a mother for the financial support she would have received from her daughter had her daughter not died, right? And what we found was asking for that $500,000 lowered the win rate because it was seen as either greedy or more likely just not credible, and it hurt credibility. So my answer, Ben, would be, you know, the life care plan only hurts the win rate if the life care plan is inflated, regardless of its actual number or value. And if it isn't, there's no reason to be afraid of the fact that it's high.
So just following up on that and the data from the 600 studies, I imagine most people, if not every person who's taken your data and actually used it in trial, follows your advice. I would hope, but this is where the question comes. How do you know whether, you know, these findings and big data actually translate in the jury room where if somebody chooses to go with the lower number, they've actually had a bad outcome?
So yes and no. All right. So we know generally we track verdicts versus what we suggested the case was worth if they followed sort of the basic advice. And we know that the verdicts are about 120% of our prediction. So if we say 10 million, the average verdict's 12. And that we kind of want to be there, right? We'd like to be a little conservative. And we also think that if you implement the advice and pick a better jury, you should beat our number, which is what we tend to see. We have a lot of cases where the result has been really, really close to the actual predicted number. Sean Claggett, for example, we predicted one case at 37.99. It was 38. We predicted another case at 44. It was 47, right? I mean, we've had a lot of close results, even just in cases he tried. But I cannot think of a situation where we've had somebody completely ignore the suggested request and go, for example, to the lowest or the worst performing result. Now, what I can tell you is, without naming any names, I can think of a couple of lawyers who got reports that said, this case is very difficult to win. You are highly likely to lose it, even if you improve it, who tried them anyway and lost because they didn't believe it. And I can also think of at least a few cases where they didn't quite reach for the highest request. They used one that was close, but not as high as the data suggested. And the verdict was lower than the prediction. And of course, you have in your head a little bit, if the attorney had felt comfortable with the higher request, I think there would have been a little more money. I think they left a little money on the table. We've certainly had that.
Okay, so what are some of the other examples?
I would say in voir dire, that's the part of like the builds and things that I like to tweak with the most. And so overall, over the course of all of these studies, the one thing I will say is that it's very difficult to have an idea of what kind of juror you need for a particular case without testing it. I know that's self-interested, but a lot of people ask on the phone call, like, well, what kind of jurors do you think I'm looking for? Am I looking for a Trump conservative or a Democrat or an African-American? And my answer is like, you don't want tort reformers. That one always pops. But after that, it kind of just depends on how a case appeals to a person and their life experience. And so I kind of came to it with this idea, especially from the city of St. Louis, that there was a certain kind of juror I was always looking for. And in doing these studies, I understand now that no, each case has its own kind of wrinkle or appeal. And that's not as predictable as maybe we once thought. So now what we're trying to do more and more when we tweak our questions is to come up with questions that that are more innocuous, that people don't, because the MAGA question, politics questions, when you can even ask them, the jurors know what you're getting at. So now one of the things that we really refine and work on are coming up with questions that a juror hears and is like, well, wow, I'm just going to say yes, because I don't even know what they're really looking for from me as an answer to that question. So that's something that we work on regularly and we like to do because it can give a lot of answers when you're presenting the case in terms of who I'm looking for, who hurts me, without how can I put together a questionnaire now that I have all of this information about jurors that are good for me or not. Yeah. That goes beyond just like gender or age or...
I was just thinking that, I don't even know if you've seen all this, but like some of the data where we've analyzed the last 10,000 jurors, for example, mm-hmm. I think you and I were talking about it, is we looked at over the last 10,000 jurors, if we know just their race, do they vote differently than the average success rate so that they'd be unusually good or unusually bad? If we know their gender, if we know their politics, if we know what kind of career they have. And what's interesting is big demographic stuff like that. If there's any difference, it's like, let's say the average percentage of jurors who vote for the plaintiff is 70%. The biggest difference we see is like 68% or 72%, which is nothing, right? Even if statistically significant, which probably isn't a sample that big, it's not enough to care, right? And so I think the data bears out that the ideas some lawyers have about good and bad jurors that sort of is stock to all cases, that we've certainly concluded isn't true and that there's no Rosetta Stone.
Even MAGA Republicans don't track as bad jurors anymore?
Let me give you a crazy example. During the pandemic, MAGA Republicans were better for Med-Mal cases than liberal Democrats.
Yeah.
And in particular, during the heart of the pandemic, they were actually better plaintiff's jurors because they were out protesting against doctors and scientists for keeping them in their house. And liberals were on their patios clapping for doctors and scientists, right? And so we actually saw for a while that MAGA Republicans would have been better for plaintiff's jurors. I mean, better for a plaintiff's Med-Mal case. And indeed, we had a case go to trial in May of 2020 outside Pittsburgh. Brendan Lupitin tried it, and he got $10.8 million with a very conservative jury because he wasn't afraid to try a case in front of these people that maybe traditionally you would have been worried about as jurors. And I will tell you, generally, we looked at politics, and conservative, moderate, and liberal has very little predictive value across all cases. Now, it's absolutely true that there are some cases where we're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Conservative jurors hurt the case by 30%, avoid them like the plague. But there are cases in which we either say there's no effect or conservatives are slightly better. As a simple example, imagine that your client, through many things that will come into the case, is going to identify as a Christian conservative who's likely a Trump supporter. All of a sudden, Trump jurors might look very different to you. And so, yeah, I mean, I second what you said, is that maybe another really surprising thing is that across the spectrum of humans, there are very few core traits that you can say, oh, that makes them good or that makes them bad for a case without knowing the case itself.
That was one frustration I had in trying the last Med-Mal case I tried, where you guys had done a data study. And when I got to voir dire, of course, we're very hamstrung by our system that doesn't allow a lot of flexibility there. But we had a really hard time figuring out what questions we could ask to identify good versus bad. And what happened in that case was essentially the judge ended up excluding anybody who had a healthcare background from our jury, which is about 25% of the jury pool. And that's true in a lot of rural areas where the only major, you know, employers in the community are healthcare providers. So, and it occurred to me after the verdict, which didn't come out well, though the data somewhat suggested that that's probably where we were heading. So we were running upstream against the data.
Yeah.
But what I realized is that what we ended up after all the healthcare people were excluded from the jury, the vast majority of our jurors were mainstream establishment people. And we were suing a neurosurgeon who's the, you know, epitome of a mainstream establishment person. And I believe that probably nurses, physical therapists, other people in the medical profession might actually have been pretty good for us. But we didn't test that in our data study. So, and I think there's other things we didn't test at that time that would have allowed us maybe some better data on who we should have put on the jury or not. I wonder, because Alicia, you raised that question of how do you identify in an individual case who's going to be good or bad for you? So how do you go about even knowing what demographics to look for in an individual case to do that?
We don't know. I mean, the truth is we don't know when the case starts. We might have instincts.
What we've created now is basically we have a general demographics set of questions that we always ask. And then we have some that are specific to each case, from motorcycle cases to personal injury cases to trucking cases.
TBI, civil rights.
Yes. So we have different. So when you run a study with us, when we're going through and figuring out what we need to do, there are like 65 core questions that jurors will always answer, because we have found them to be predictive, like, are you a victim of a crime? Do you own a gun? Those type of things. But then we also have more specific questions that we ask depending on your case. And then what we do is kind of cross our fingers. I mean, it's one of my favorite things. When we press play and the study runs, I'm like, who's going to pop on this one? Because you don't always know. And sometimes you get, you know, so in my civil rights cases, I get more information that I could possibly want in terms of demographic information about jurors, because it's very polarizing. So the more polarized a case is, typically, the more we see in the demographic voir dire section of things popping that people are having a strong opinion about.
Maybe we should say what pop is, because I think, well, I'm just saying, because I was just thinking that their question is, how do you know, which ones will matter? And you're right. The answer is we don't know when we start. We might have suspicions or from past studies, instincts on questions to ask. But actually, you know, it's less sexy than it sounds, because it's data, right? So imagine you have 400 people who voted on liability and damages, and then you do an analysis or regression analysis or some sort of analysis to see who's good and bad. Well, if you want to visualize that, just imagine if you took, let's say, my level of education, and you took everybody who had a high school degree and put them in one room, everybody who had an associate's degree and put them in another room, everybody who had a bachelor's and put them in another room, everybody who didn't graduate high school in another room. And then you said, what's the average win rate in each room? And what's the average value on damages in each room? Well, if you saw that everybody who went to college only and had a degree are 10% better on liability and 30% better on damages, and you ran a pretty simple statistical test, which calculates a p-value, which just means, is this likely to happen by accident, or is this most likely truly a real effect? Not something that could happen by happenstance. Well, when you have 40, 50, 60 people in each room and you see a meaningful difference, and you measure it and say, yeah, this is statistically sound, then you call it out for that case. And you say, in this case, playing the odds, people with a college degree vote differently at a statistically significant level than people without.
And we call that popping.
They pop.
Yeah, they pop.
P-value pop. And so that's a good juror. And you do that thousands of times on all the characteristics that you have. And the level we use is we use the same p-value that you'd use to publish in a scientific journal, right? If you were going to say, this medicine does in fact lower cholesterol compared to the placebo. All right, well, there's a statistical test based on how many people you had that you sampled and how big the effect was to see if that's a statistically meaningful result. We do the same thing. And then we have sometimes only a few, sometimes a ton of predictors of good and bad jurors.
And what we've done is refined our questions based on the 600 studies that we figured out, like, okay, in TBI questions, really to help attorneys, we need to ask this batch of questions because they tend to pop, where people have an opinion that if you're going to tell me that your client has a TBI, but we don't have imaging You need to know what jurors are going to say about that because they're going to have opinions. And so one of the things we've done is really refined it. Trucking cases are different than just the auto accident cases is what we've found over time.
Sure.
So we tend to ask all of those and then do the analysis and try to give you as many characteristics as possible of a person that you either want or you don't.
Well, I was just going to say, I'll just mention, this is a good example of maybe why we ended up writing Jury Ball is because imagine you have a list now of 15 traits that are great for you and 15 traits that are bad for you in the case. That's one thing. But then how you actually get jurors to talk enough to tell you those things, how you do some combination of questionnaires, potential background research, and jury selection to get enough information to then score out those jurors, right, is a different thing. And you two guys are your old pros and you can do it. But there are a lot of attorneys who would look at it and say, okay, great. But how do I find this stuff out in a way that doesn't creep jurors out? Or how do I talk to them to get them to feel comfortable enough with me that they're going to reveal honestly some of these beliefs they have about brain injury or that they have about trucks or that they have about insurance or plaintiff's lawyers? And so I think, you know, the application of the data to sort of real life is the thing that we've maybe put a lot of energy into lately, right? We continue to refine the data and we've got a great team of really smart PhDs who help us do it. But making that data then get implemented at sort of its highest and best use is this kind of the second part of the work.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show. That produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. One of the challenges, as you explained, you've got the list of good traits and bad traits, is that most people are not monolithic. They're a combination of traits, and they're a combination of some good traits and some bad traits. But the key is, what is the trait that's the distinguishing trait for your particular case that's really going to make a difference? And we just interviewed Rahul about his jiu-jitsu $46 million verdict case. And I remember you explaining, Rahul, that in that case, the key trait was whether jurors believed that when you signed up for jiu-jitsu, you assumed the risk of bad things happening versus jurors who believed that the instructors had to be careful to prevent bad things from happening, right?
Yeah, and I'll just say, and that's the case that I worked with John on, so I don't want to get into too much detail on it right now, and we should do a separate session on it, but it was incredibly valuable to have your work product to give us some guidance on everything. We did in-person focus groups, and then John's big data, and a compilation of it all really helped us in theming the case, voir dire questions, of course, and exposing the bias in a number of jurors, which came out rather quickly because of the way that we did it, because of the data that we had. So I'm a huge fan of you guys, not just from observation, but from actually using your work product too.
Thanks, man. Well, we're in the Mutual Admiration Society because we're big fans of you too. So that was a really cool result. And I mean, hey, by the way, I don't want to go too far into your case because I know you'd be still pending and all that, but I will just say this, your case is like another, when we're talking about these like big examples of things you learn, a lot of attorneys have this idea that the way to drive up injury is to talk about how hurt their client is. And that sounds obvious, right? I mean, if I want to prove my client's injured, I should talk about how injured they are. Your case is like a great example of how untrue that can be, because you know better than us, but I mean, your client was badly hurt, potentially a quadriplegic who then climbs a mountain, right? Makes an amazing recovery. And what we saw in that study, and we see across studies, is that if the plaintiff is a fighter and if they're framed as a fighter, jurors don't discount the level of injury. If anything, they increase it, right? Because they want to be cheering for someone. They want to give money to someone that it will help, not into a black hole of sorrow and sadness, right? And so your case is a great example of where when we measured injury severity, they rated the injury as very, very severe, even though he'd made an extraordinary recovery. And that's because, in my view, one of the things we've started to believe is jurors don't give like injury mitigation to the defense. So if the plaintiff fights really hard to overcome their injury, we should never be afraid that, oh no, that means that the jury won't think there's much need to give damages. If anything, award more, because they've seen the hard work of the plaintiff and they believe that they're now helping someone who will use it. And so that's another one that we see all the time, that people will send us studies and it's really sad and sort of almost whiny, the description of injury. And now we've sometimes rewritten it and, to make our point, tested it with the whiny kind and tested it with the sort of victor story, like, hey, let's go get it. He's fighting. Maybe he's depressed, but he's going to make it. He's getting counseling. He's working on it. And what we see is damages climb when you frame the person as a fighter every time. That's another one of those sort of things that lots of studies have borne out.
Just generally speaking, and I think this has been for at least as long as I've been practicing law, and probably even before that, Ben, I wanted to hear your thoughts on it too. But that's always been an issue that I think trial lawyers struggle with, at least at the outset, is a significant injury, or maybe not as significant of an injury, but your client has done everything in their power to maximize their recovery, whatever level that may be. And just that initial fear that the defense is somehow going to capitalize on that and minimize the severity of the harms and losses, and getting your head around that and then embracing your client and recognizing that they are a hero and somebody to actually be admired for everything they've done for themselves. That's one of those mental exercises that takes a lot of work, at least for me, in getting my head in the right place and starting to present that. Is that something that you've dealt with as well, Ben?
Well, John and I mean, the perfect example is that funeral case we did where there were no physical injuries or economic losses at all. And I think when you're confronting a case where you don't have anything to work with at all with respect to those categories, you're forced to dig deeper into what is really motivating verdicts. And in that case, we motivated them to give a lot of money in the verdict, I think primarily because of the conduct of the defendant, which I still see over and over again in our mini focus groups and in the data, seems to drive the verdict values more than the damages numbers. And then when it gets to damages, they're looking for a vehicle to turn their frustration or anger into a verdict. So I think once you start with that insight, to me anyway, that really helps a lot in terms of how to start thinking and framing damages. But, you know, we do these really sad medical malpractice cases where, and we just had one where a young woman is a permanent vegetative state, but really it's a hopeless situation. There's nothing that can be done to, you know, to improve her quality of life. I much prefer somebody who's recovered and has a success story to tell to the hopelessness. It's really hard for me to even know what to do with a hopeless case like that. Why are we even in front of a jury? What's the jury going to do for them, right? So then you're back to thinking about the verdict as a vehicle for their frustration and anger. But I don't know, do you guys, has that been borne out with the data, that the teaching that verdicts are more about the conduct of the defendant versus compensating victims? Does that tend to be true, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, so just to tell you in one chart, we used to measure, we'd ask jurors after they render a verdict, are you angry at the defendant? And we'd also ask jurors, do you feel sorry for the plaintiff?
Yep.
Do you feel sympathy for the plaintiff? The level of sympathy that was reported for the plaintiff had little or no impact on the amount jurors awarded. There was no correlation. There is always, in every study we've ever run, that's about 600 now, a correlation between anger at the defendant and the amount awarded, in that people who are more angry give more. So we view caring about the plaintiff as necessary but not sufficient. It's absolutely true that if you have a shit plaintiff that's a terrible person, or that's presented poorly, or presented as helpless in a way that's not fair or seems whiny or exaggerated, jurors will stop caring. But once they say, this is a real person, I care about this, I want to help, what really drives how much they give is directly related to how much they feel like they're righting a wrong, which one measure of that's anger. There's actually one of the people who does statistics with our team is a professor at ASU named Jessica Salerno, and she studied this in detail. And one of the things she found was, it's mostly in the criminal context, but that the combination of anger and disgust those two in particular, when together, charge people to act. And so, Ben, I'm thinking of your case where you beat the numbers in the funeral home case, or in the, you know, in that case, you had anger at how disrespectful they were. And you had a visceral disgust, too, at the scene itself and decomposing bodies and terrible treatment of a human. And I think that's probably those two things like combined. And as you say, even though you don't have an economic model or a non-economic injury in our traditional sense, combined to sort of be rocket fuel for jurors sometimes.
What kind of things have you seen that tend to incite juror anger? And I ask that because when we focus group cases and put stuff out there, the thing that I think might be the trigger often is not. And it's something else that I didn't think about. Sometimes it's something that seems relatively minor, like they didn't train somebody on a particular issue, that we put it in the case because we're layering it up with the other evidence, but it didn't seem that important to me. And then the jurors sit around for 2 hours and talk about nothing but the training. Even though, you know, or something like that. Are you seeing patterns in terms of what tends to cause jurors to get upset?
Hiding documents, any kind of that type of malfeasance where if your plaintiff's credible, but I mean, if what you've got is a defendant that is trying to bury the truth, or that's what at least seems like to jurors because they're not turning things over in discovery, or there's proof that things have been destroyed so they could never be turned over, jurors hate that.
It's interesting that that is independent of a spoliation instruction.
Yes.
Right. So we've also studied it where we weren't sure if the court would give the instruction. So we've studied it with and without the instruction, and the instruction makes almost no difference. So what's really the gold in the case is that the jurors get it. And if they decide, oh, you're trying to keep information from us, you're trying to hide what you did, it's this double, because one, serves as a proxy for an admission, because why would you hide it if it was good? And two, it's sneaky. I think similarly, in many cases, pride. And what I mean by that is think about med mal cases. You know, often the difference between jurors being mad at the doctor or not is not how egregious the error was, but whether it seemed to have been motivated by a sort of God complex or was a genuine mistake. And so in many cases, some sort of something, an indicia that the defendant was more reckless than negligent, didn't know their limits, seems to do it. That sounds obvious, but it's true. And then I think another one is sort of a lack of repentance, right? Yes. So interestingly, post-remedial measures, when we test them because they may or may not come in, they typically drive up the win rate because people go, oh, well, if they fixed it later, they must have had a problem, right? So post-remedial measures help the plaintiff win, but they drive down damages because jurors say, but there's nothing to fix now. It's been fixed. And the defendant must not be so bad because at least they fixed it. The contrast of that is if you're able to say they did this terrible thing and today it's the same, we see anger levels rise, right? I mean, those are a few of the things that come to mind.
Or a consistent inability to admit that something, like especially if you have a case where it's obviously the defendant's fault, but they will not admit it. So that they're almost like entrenched in their position. Or even sometimes we've had them where they're putting blame on the plaintiff for something that the jurors are like, no, this is clearly your fault. That will trigger anger in jurors because they do want to see some kind of
repentance
or sad, you know, like acknowledgement that maybe they contributed. So sometimes when I'm on the phone, I'm like, so what is defense saying? They're like, oh no, they're all out. I'm like, wow, if they're all after your plaintiff with these set of facts that I'm listening to, that might be a good thing for you because jurors will not like it.
We see a case a week, I bet, in which we think, are you sure the defense isn't going to admit liability? And then the defense digs in anyway. They get some expert to come in and blame the plaintiff or blame the employer or blame somebody else or make an excuse. And they drive up the value of the case for the plaintiff, right? So that sort of willful ignorance or denial is another one that really, you know, often attorneys will call us and they're really frustrated. They're like, man, they're still saying my client caused this. I think it's so ridiculous. And often our advice is, look, let's test it because it's probably great. And probably the last thing you want them to do is come to Jesus and admit that they're wrong.
That's interesting. So the actual litigation tactics can affect verdict value. It's not just the underlying facts, but how they're handling the issues at trial or in discovery. That actually does make a big difference.
I think often a significant difference.
So what's happened over the 600 studies that you've done over that period of time? Have you observed some changes in behavior or reactions by prospective jurors over time? I know you made the reference to Med-Mal cases and post-pandemic and, you know, MAGA jurors versus liberal jurors. Any other types of observations you've seen where you could say jurors have changed over time?
I mean, I'll just tell you that generally, to expand on that a little, the litigation environment for plaintiffs is better now than it was when we started. And I mean that in almost every way you can measure it. There are less toxic jurors for plaintiffs than there used to be. The pandemic and whatever kind of happened in those years has softened bad jurors. And so there's less scary venues, I think, and less toxic jurors. And I think the win rate has crept up.
When I think the defense knows it, at least the insurance agencies do. You know, I follow a lot of their websites where they're trying to figure out why there's so many nuclear verdicts. You know, litigation financing, I think, has really helped with that. And then the fact that there's, you know, kind of a political environment where now jurors see themselves stepping into a box, being able to actually make change. So it's a powerful place for plaintiff's lawyers right now, I think. And it's certainly, yeah.
It
I mean, because even my two cents was going to be excessive force cases have changed and they are less difficult now. Jurors are more open to those now.
But I would say that about Med-Mal cases too.
Yeah, I mean.
And so if you took it, you're right that it hasn't happened in every, but you're right. Excessive force cases are better for plaintiffs than they used to be. There are more people who will listen. There are less people who are just like, no, no, no. Med-Mal cases are the same. I don't know if there's been massive shifts in some types of cases, but on net then the result has been numbers are bigger. If anything, right now, what we're saying a lot to attorneys is don't listen to the defense when they tell you what the biggest verdict in the state has been. You don't listen to yourself when you think about, in the past, I would have never asked for more than. And let's not be our own damage cap, because there's a lot more room in a lot of these cases than maybe all of us, based on our instincts, would believe.
That's true.
And maybe people getting better at this and utilizing data has also contributed to better results.
Well, we hope so. We hope it'll help.
Well, guys, we really appreciate your coming back on and talk about your new book. So how do people, I actually don't have a copy of the book yet. I'd like to get it. How do we go about getting ourselves a copy of your book?
Well, because we are behind, you don't have a copy because we don't have a copy. So the book is done. It's called Jury Ball. It'll be about big data and implementing it. Alicia, myself, and Sean have written it. That's all true. But it is not published because the publisher came back. Of course, when you see those, you've gone through this, Ben, and Rahul, you may have too. You see these notes and you go, okay, I'll fix that. You do, and you send it back. So we're at the phase now where it's about to be sent out for page layout and kind of finalized. And then our plan is to self-publish as well and make it available on a website and make it easy to get. And the website will be juryball.com, so it'll be easy to find.
Okay. Well, by the time the podcast comes out, maybe the book will be out.
I think we'll be close. Yeah. I don't know when this will come out, but you know, the summer is always tricky, but we think that we're, you know, a month or two out from it being sort of all done. Of course, it's our first time, so we don't know what we don't know, right? We don't know when somebody's going to go, actually, that takes a long time, or you idiots, you should have done this. But so far, so good. I think we're mostly there.
Well, I'm excited for it to come out and then excited to read it. So congratulations on finishing the book and congratulations on all your successes.
Thank you so much. And thank you both for having us. This is always so much fun.
It's nice to meet you guys.
We
always learn while we're here too.
Yeah. Thanks so much. And look forward to working with you again. I know we're about to send off another case and it's always exciting. So thank you.
That'll be great.
Yeah. It
is. All right. Thank you guys.
Have a good day.
You too.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.